From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ahmad Chalabi was once presumed to be the Bush administration's choice to serve as the first president of the new Iraq. He had helped convince the Pentagon and the White House to invade his country and overthrow Saddam Hussein. But now, writes Dexter Filkins, many people see Chalabi as the personification of all that has gone wrong in Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Filkins about his profile of Chalabi, published in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Filkins covered Iraq from the time of the invasion until the end of August. Also, essential art house movies. John Powers reviews a new 50-DVD collection of films from the Janus Distribution Company, including Truffaut's The 400 Blows, Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes, and Bergman's The Seventh Seal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For many people in the West, Ahmet Chalabi has become the personification of all that has gone wrong in Iraq, the lies, the arrogance, the occupation as disaster. So writes my guest Dexter Filkins, who profiled Chalabi in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He describes Chalabi as the man who persuaded the most powerful men and women in the U.S. to make the liberation of Iraq not merely a priority, but an obsession. First in 1998, when Chalabi persuaded Congress to pass the Iraq Liberation Act, and then later in persuading the Bush administration of the necessity of using force to destroy Saddam Hussein. Chalabi's group of Iraqi exiles, the Iraqi National Congress, received over $27 million from the U.S. over a period of 6 years. But the information he gave the U.S. was often inaccurate and misleading. Filkins covered Iraq for the New York Times from the invasion in 2003 until the end of August this year. He's known Chalabi for 3.5 years. Currently, Filkins is based at Harvard University, where he has a Nieman Fellowship. I asked him to describe how Ahmet Chalabi made the case for invading Iraq.
Well, there's no super easy one-line answer, but I'll attempt it.
Go.
First I should say, if you look at the reports and there was this fabulous moment, which it's in the story, but it was last year, and he came to Washington, Chalabi did, and he spoke in front of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a think tank in Washington. And he was asked by somebody, would you like to apologize to the American people for bringing the country to war? And he stood up and said, well, the idea that I sold the Bush administration on WMD is an urban myth. And, half the room gasped. You could hear them. But actually, he's not terribly far off. That's not quite accurate. But there was a Senate report, a big, lengthy investigation, the Rob Silverman report, that said essentially, it didn't say that Chalabi had played a constructive role. It just said that the stuff he gave us, we didn't use, basically, or didn't use much of it. But the story doesn't end there. And again, it's without going on too long, there's another Senate report that says his intelligence, the defectors, basically, the Iraqi defectors that he gave to American intelligence, directly affected some of the judgments about going to war and about whether Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. But the most interesting conversation I had, and the one I think that shed the most light for me, was a conversation with David Kay, who was the head of the Iraq Survey Group, the guy who went in after the invasion to look for WMD. And what he said was the following. It's kind of complicated, but it's very revealing. He said that the CIA, i.e. George Tenet, at the time, didn't really trust Chalabi. They'd had a falling out many years before. They weren't really buying what he was selling them or what he was giving them. But that Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy defense secretary, Vice President Cheney, Rumsfeld, they believed Chalabi, and so they, having been essentially armed with the information that Chalabi gave them, they pressured Tenet, and Tenet ultimately caved, even though he didn't really buy what was in front of him.
So, what's some of the information that Chalabi actually gave the Bush administration?
One of the main guys is a guy named, and I'm forgetting his first name, but his last name is Al-Haidari, and he was a defector. I think he went to Jordan, and then I think that's where the INC, Chalabi's group, the Iraqi National Congress, made contact with him. And I think that they met American intelligence in a safe house in Bangkok, if I remember correctly. And Haidari told him a number of things. God is in the details here, so I need to be a little careful. But essentially, I think Haidari said, I have seen buildings and I've seen structures that look like mobile labs or laboratories used for the construction of or the, maintenance of chemical and biological weapons, that sort of thing. That was one of the main pieces that Chalabi gave them.
And did Chalabi also make it seem that if we invaded Iraq, we would be welcomed as liberators and it would be, pretty easy to create an Iraqi democracy?
Well, you raise a kind of larger point, which I tried to say in the piece, which is if you just kind of, it's not really accurate just to say, or just to ask yourself the question, what is it that Chalabi gave to U.S. intelligence? Because if you go back to before the war, Chalabi was not just doing that. He was doing any number of other things. His group was disseminating information to newspapers all across the country, to television stations all across the country, some of which turned out to be absolutely false, allegations, for example, that Saddam was involved in the September 11th attacks and, you know, there were terrorist camps, you know, where they were practicing hijacking and that sort of stuff. And that stuff was making it into the, because it made it into the newspapers, including ours, it was kind of, I mean, he was sort of beating the drum in public, not just with you know, American intelligence, but so that he was instrumental, I think it's fair to say, he was instrumental in sort of helping to create the climate, the public climate that existed at the time that the decision to go to war was made.
Now, you've been talking about some of the people who blame him for bad information that led us into the war in Iraq. But he points his finger to the Pentagon, and he says that the Pentagon guys chickened out. And what does he think the Pentagon did wrong?
Well, he's making a slightly different point, Chalabi is, when he blames the Pentagon. What Chalabi says, and I think you can say, it's fair to say that a lot of the people who supported the war, the very strong war supporters back in 2003, this is what they say now. I mean, I've heard this argument now from not just Chalabi, but Richard Perle and any number of other people who supported the war back then, was that the Pentagon blew it this way. When Saddam fell and the Americans rolled into Baghdad, what they did, of course, was they set up an occupation authority. They brought in Paul Bremer. The city was in flames. The Iraqis were looting. And they kept 150,000 American troops in there and proceeded, you know, in the way that they did. And what Chalabi says is that what they should have done and what he believed they were going to do, what the Americans were going to do at the time, was instead of imposing an American kind of occupation authority on Iraq and then thereby guaranteeing the unpopularity of the Americans and kind of humiliating the Iraqis with this term occupation, what they should have done is put Iraqis in charge and allowed the Iraqis, that means Chalabi, of course, to set up an interim government, essentially an Iraqi government that could have taken over. And if they would have done that, if the Americans would have done that, as Chalabi and others were urging at the time, and I think it's fair to say they were urging it at the time.
Well, he was hoping to be the head of that government too, wasn't he?
He was. Of course he was, yeah. There were a number of Iraqi, most of them were exiles at the time, who were pretty close to the Americans as the invasion was kind of unfolding. And, you know, there was actually a meeting that took place in Baghdad, you know, cities on fire in April 2003. They met with Zalmay Khalilzad, who's now the American ambassador to Iraq, and he at the time was the special envoy to the Iraqi opposition. And they described this meeting, and it's Chalabi, it's all the big exiles, it's Chalabi and Barzani and Alawi and all these people. And they basically made the case to Khalilzad as they describe it. They say, look, put us in charge. You know, we can do this. We're Iraqis. We understand the language. We know the culture. We can act firmly where you can't. And as they tell the story, and I don't know this part, I don't really know if it's true or not, but that Khalilzad was very receptive to it and said, okay, I'll go back to Washington and see what I can do. And, he didn't appear on the scene again for another two years. But, you know, a couple weeks later, Paul Bremer showed up with a totally different set of marching orders. So, but I should just say, as I do in the piece, I mean, and I think it's Chalabi basically says the Pentagon should have done it my way. They should have done it that way. And they chickened out. And that's how they blew it. Because, you know, they had the Americans in charge instead of the Iraqis. And so everything went bad. But for that scenario really to be plausible, you have to imagine what Iraq was like at the time. I mean, it was in a state of total chaos and total anarchy. I mean, I was there. The place was on fire. There was no Iraqi army. There was no Iraqi police force. There was no Iraqi government. of any sort. I mean, all the government buildings were being looted, you know, I mean, by 10 a.m. On April 9th, 2003, as the American tanks were rolling in, the Iraqis were descending on all the government buildings and tearing them to pieces. So there wasn't anything, you know, when Chalabi says, well, the Pentagon chickened out and they should have put us in charge, it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't really ring true. Maybe it would have been possible, but it seems hard to believe. I mean, that basically, you know, a dozen Iraqis, who some of whom have been out of the country, like Chalabi for 45 years, could sort of come in and sort of take over and start, you know, pulling the levers of power. I mean, I think in this case, the levers weren't connected to anything.
In terms of his relationship with the United States government, Chalabi has gone from close friend to enemy. I'm not sure what his status is now. I'll ask you that again a little bit later. But the enemy part really becomes clear in May 2004 when his home was raided by American and Iraqi agents. What were they looking for?
Well, it's amazing the ups and downs here. You know, Chalabi as the favorite son, and then Chalabi is the enemy, and then Chalabi goes back to Washington, and he's the favorite son again, and now he's kind of, yeah, now he's somewhere between those two poles. I think now he's regarded as irrelevant, which I think is probably the most stinging thing for him of all. But to go to the raid on Chalabi, to the American raid on Chalabi's house, that was in May 2004. I was actually there. At the time, and they surrounded his neighborhood with a bunch of Humvees, and the American troops did, and then Iraqi agents went in with some American agents. Not really clear who the American guys were; they were probably intelligence people, and raided his house. There's a bunch of different reasons that I've heard for why they did it, but the most compelling one is that there was an allegation that Chalabi had told the Iranian government that the Americans had cracked their secret codes and were listening to them. And so that, you know, that was regarded as sort of a gigantic betrayal by the Americans. And so they kind of swooped in. And that really made the break final.
So is he no longer considered to have spied for Iran or you know, betrayed America by giving secrets to Iran?
It's unclear. I mean, it's at the time, you know, the Americans were fulminating about that. But then again, I remember when in November, this is just about a year ago, November 2005, when he returned to Washington. You know, he was running for parliament. He had kind of an outside shot to be prime minister. So he, you know, they welcomed him back. He met with Rumsfeld. He met with Secretary of State Rice. He met with Cheney. You know, those allegations were forgotten. They were, you know, I called around to people in Washington and said, well, what happened to the allegation that he had tipped off the Iranians? And it just kind of went away. And so it makes you wonder if it was ever true or whether they just couldn't prove it. I don't know.
My guest is Dexter Filkins of The New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dexter Filkins, and he covered Iraq for the New York Times from the time of the invasion until just a couple of months ago. In this Sunday's magazine of the Times, he has an article about Ahmad Chalabi. Well, you actually went on a trip with Ahmad Chalabi to Iran. What was his mission there?
Well, that's a really difficult question to answer. I should say it was an amazing trip because we drove to Iran, and we drove across the border, and I mean everything about it was amazing and also mysterious. We drove across eastern Iraq out of Baghdad, and in this enormous armed convoy. You know, we had about 30 cars and about 50 guys with machine guns, and drove to the border in this little border town called Mehran. But I remember as we drove into Iran, you know, the entire geography changes. I mean, you know you're in another country, and it was kind of very romantic because it was sort of the, you know, the old historic boundary between the Persian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and you could really feel the world changing, you know. And but then we got there, and we crossed the border, and we drove to the nearest airport, which wasn't, I don't know, half an hour away, and there was a private jet waiting waiting for Chalabi, an Iranian government jet. And then we all got in and flew to Tehran. But at the time, I mean, there were so many different things happening that it's difficult to say exactly what Chalabi was doing there. But I think, you know, he wanted to be prime minister at the time, and I think he wanted to talk to the Iranians about that.
What about backing him?
Well, or not getting in his way. You know, would you oppose this? In other words, that was sort of my best assessment, because I think the answer would be, you know, the Iranians loom very large in Iraq, and they loom very large in that part of the world. And they're, you know, in the intelligence world, they're regarded as being very, very sophisticated. And I think if the Iranians didn't want Chalabi to run for prime minister, then he probably wouldn't have, you know. I mean, as it happens, he didn't become prime minister, but it doesn't look like they were opposed to it.
We actually met with President Ahmadinejad, so he has to have some sense of power in Iran. I mean, what gives him that kind of authority that he could get a meeting with the president?
Well, that's another really good question. I mean, at the time, you know, this was November 2005. It was just about a year ago, and of course, when he finished meeting in Tehran, meeting Ahmadinejad, he flew to Washington and met with, you know, Rice and Rumsfeld and the others. So he had a lot of currency at the time. I don't know if he'd get a meeting with any of those people today because he's out of power. You know, I mean, I think there was an expectation that he might actually be somebody that to be reckoned with in Iraq after the elections. As it happens, you know, he lost. He didn't get a seat. But so I think, you know, I think. But I think the larger answer to your question is that at least according to many of the people that I talk to, and I mean Iraqis but also American intelligence agents, Chalabi has had a very long-standing relationship with Iran, pretty close. I mean, Bob Baer, the guy who wrote See No Evil, a kind of very well-known CIA agent, as well-known as these people can be, went as far as to say he thinks he always regarded Chalabi, and he knows Chalabi, and he's worked with him, and he said, Chalabi never lied to me. He was always extremely straight with me. But he said, I always regarded Chalabi as essentially a double agent, that basically he was working for Iran. And so he Baer said, you know, we had to account for that, essentially.
Well, how ironic is that? I mean, if in fact Chalabi helped lead us into the war in Iraq, and if in fact he was working in any way as a double agent with Iran, and Iran is on the axis of evil, and now they have a nuclear program that the Bush administration is trying to stop, it becomes very confusing at the very least, doesn't it?
Well, there's a lot of paradox there. Yeah, I mean, I think, but I mean, to be fair to Chalabi, I mean, he completely dismisses that notion, and mm-hmm. I think. Actually, his friend Richard Perle, I put this in the story I wrote on Sunday as well, but he put it pretty well. He said, look, does he have a relationship with the Iranians? Of course he does. You have to have a relationship with the Iranians to operate in that part of the world. The more important question is, what kind of relationship is it? And he said, my feeling is, this was Perle talking about his friend Chalabi, my feeling is that Chalabi has been very skillful at getting more out of the Iranians than they ever got out of him. Mm-hmm. And that's another way to look at it. So, you know, it's a hall of mirrors, the Middle East. And that's one example.
So how would you describe Chalabi's status now in Iraq?
Well, I guess I'd describe it in like this. He's officially, he's not in power. His party didn't win enough votes for even one seat in the Iraqi parliament. So in that sense, he's irrelevant. But Chalabi is kind of he's a force of nature He's absolutely relentless. He's totally driven. He's brilliant. And so I think he's still a force to be reckoned with, or maybe to be reckoned with in the future. I mean, I think it would probably be wrong to conclude that he won't be back. So I think, you know, I think we haven't heard the last of him.
One of the things that's been said about Chalabi is that he fed a lot of misleading information to journalists during the run-up to the war in Iraq, information related to weapons of mass destruction. Judy Miller, for instance, who at the time was writing for the New York Times, your paper, used him as a source in her articles about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. So when you talk to Chalabi, are you very cautious about accepting anything that he says? I mean, is he hard to trust knowing that he misled journalists?
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't, I mean, I would say, you know, that's the same really for anything, but I mean, you know, I know his track record in that regard. And you know, and I think, I mean, our paper has been very clear about, you know, what we thought was kind of a failure on our part to scrutinize the information more carefully before we put it into print before the war. And so, yeah, you got to I mean, I would do this with anyone, but you've got to you can't just take information like that at face value. I mean, you've got to run it down and try to verify it independently, of course.
Dexter Filkins covered Iraq for the New York Times from the start of the invasion until August of this year. His profile of Ahmet Chalabi was published in Sunday's New York Times magazine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And from CNN, presenting election night with Wolf Blitzer, Anderson Cooper, Lou Dobbs, Paula Zahn, and Larry King. Tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern on CNN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jules and Jim, The Seventh Seal, The Rules of the Game, and 47 other classics. John Powers reviews a new DVD collection called Essential Art House. And Dexter Filkins shares his impressions of Iraq after reporting on it since the invasion. He left Iraq in late August. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dexter Filkins. He left Baghdad in August after covering Iraq for the New York Times since the start of the invasion in March 2003. He won a George Polk Award for war reporting for his coverage of the Battle of Fallujah. He's currently based at Harvard University, where he has a Nieman Fellowship. Filkins profiled Ahmet Chalabi in Sunday's New York Times magazine. As an Iraqi exile, Chalabi helped persuade the U.S. to invade Iraq, but much of his information was inaccurate and misleading. He had hoped to lead the new Iraq, but now finds himself spurned by both the American and Iraqi leadership. you know, we're talking about your profile of Ahmet Çalabi, and of course, you've known him for several years, and you've traveled in his convoy. What is it like to travel in his convoy, and do you feel like safer because you're traveling with all these armed guards, or do you feel like more of a target because you're traveling in Çalabi's convoy?
Well, I should say, I mean, to be fair to Çalabi, I've traveled with a number of Iraqi politicians, or frankly, anybody who has enough money to do this does it the same way. You can't get in your car in Baghdad or anywhere else in Iraq and just drive down the street without being fairly certain you'd be killed. The typical Iraqi politician now, or businessman, has an army, basically, that protects him. In Çalabi's case, I drove him to a couple places, once to the border of Iran, and another we went to a town called Mushab in southern Iraq. But, God, it was like 30 cars, maybe three guys in each car with Kalashnikovs. We were driving, you know, 70 miles an hour. We were going south. Sometimes we were in the southbound lane. Sometimes we would the entire convoy would veer into the northbound lane. Guys hanging out the window with their machine guns, really, really menacing the oncoming traffic. The cars that were coming towards us had to go off the road. I mean, it was crazy. It was insane. That said, it's hard to imagine traveling any other way there. I mean, that's the way it is there. It's a state of nature now, Iraq. And if you want to travel, if you're, you know, if you're an Iraqi in a position of power, or if you have some wealth or whatever, people are going to want to kill you, or they're going to want to kidnap you. And so that's the way they travel.
Well, what about the roadside bombs? How does, like, a Çalabi convoy protect itself against them?
Well, you go fast is the short answer. And that's if you look at the way even American Humvees now, when they're on the roads in Iraq, if you go back to 2003, they're cruising around, you know, 20 miles an hour in a Humvee. And now they go 50 miles an hour, and they weave, and they, you know, they go down the middle of the road, not the side, and they back and forth. I mean, it's crazy, and that's the way people have to drive now.
But I thought you had to look for things on the road that might be IEDs, and that's hard to do, I'd imagine, if you're going 50 miles an hour as opposed to 20.
Well, it depends on what you're trying to do. if you're trying to get from point A to point B and live, you drive really, really fast with guns hanging out the window, swerving the whole way. If you're on a patrol, say, with an American military unit that's looking for IEDs, it's really terrifying. I've done that too. You go 5 miles an hour, and you look down at the road really, really carefully for every little wire that might be sticking out.
You have an incredible description of what Iraq has been like in your profile of Çalabi. And I just want to read this. You write, "Iraq was a nightmarish, apocalyptic place where gunmen kidnapped children and sometimes killed them, where bodies turned up at the morgue, peppered by the hole from electric drills, and corpses lay uncollected in the streets along with the trash for days on end." Is everything in that list something that you actually witnessed?
Yeah, definitely. That's pretty bleak, but that's pretty accurate, too. Yeah, I mean, if you just take the visits to the morgue, it's pretty amazing on any given day. I mean, I think, you know, in Iraq now, as best anybody can count, about 100 people a day are being killed, civilians, Iraqi civilians, most of it in sectarian killings. And it's not merely, you know, bullet to the head, bang, you're dead. It's, you know, you see the bodies, and the bodies are, they're handcuffed, they're blindfolded. They're drilled with holes. There's some kind of grim fascination there with electric drills. That's amazing. They're burned with acid. There's, you know, letters carved into their skin. You know, I could go on and on here. But it's in a really kind of basic way, it's become dehumanized. You know, there's so much death there that it just, life just doesn't really have that much value anymore.
When you left Iraq in August, how mobile were you as a reporter? How much was your reporting restricted compared to what had been, say, even a year earlier?
It's pretty restricted. You know, I mean, all of us really still go out every day, and we still, you know, we make a really, really hard effort to get out and talk to Iraqis every day, because you got to do that, you know, to really understand what's happening. But having said that, the areas that you can operate in have just shrunk so much. And so stuff like I mean, you know, as a reporter, for me, I mean, I can't sort of pull over and walk into a crowd and talk to people the way that I used to. I can't. I mean, I'm an American male and I look very American. I can't do that. I can go to people's houses, you know, I can call them up and I can schedule a time to come over. But even that is getting really, really difficult. I mean, and I'll give you an example. I mean, it's like it's hard for me to go to, you know, Ahmed's house because it's so dangerous for me. But it's really, really dangerous for him. You know, he doesn't want somebody who looks like me in his neighborhood. You know, I get out of the car and the whole neighborhood starts talking. My God, there's an American walking into Ahmed's house, you know, and that puts him in danger. So I'll give you an example.
Are you talking about Ahmed Chalabi here?
No, Ahmed anybody.
Ahmed anybody,
no,
okay.
No, I mean anybody. No, no, right. No. I mean any Iraqi. You know, if you talk to the average Iraqi, the first thing they'll tell you is, you know, I'm an Iraqi and I'm not sectarian and I may be a Shiite, but, you know, I'm married to a Sunni or my brother's married to a Sunni and we're all Iraqis and nobody cares about sectarian stuff. And I think that was really true, you know, and it's been true for hundreds of years. And one of the reasons why now Baghdad is so bloody is because all these neighborhoods are mixed. You know, if you're in a neighborhood, it's got Sunnis on one street and Shiites on the next and Christians on the other and Kurds as well. And so all that's changing. It's because, you know, this terrible, terrible dynamic has taken over of sectarian killing. And it's really just kind of a self-sustaining storm now. And so these neighborhoods are dividing up and they're dividing ethnically. And so a kind of, you know, super rough dividing line is the Tigris River. It runs right down the middle of Baghdad. And it's Sunni on the west, predominantly, and Shiite on the east. But, you know, to watch that happen is a terrible thing. You know, I mean, I went to a, just to tell you a story, I went to a refugee camp not long ago. It was in a Shiite neighborhood called Shab. I'm not even sure if I could go to Shab now. It's a Shiite refugee camp, and it's filled with Shiite people who had come in from the countryside, which is largely Sunni, and they'd all been ethnically cleansed from their homes. And I remember sitting in this one guy's tent, Mr. Carmet, I think his name was. And Mr. Carmet was from Dora, which is a predominantly Sunni Christian neighborhood in southern Baghdad. And he pulled out a piece of paper that he had with him, and the piece of paper said, you know, this is Muhammad's army, and we're cleansing this area of the dirty Shia. You've got 48 hours to get your family out of here. We're going to kill you. And so he'd packed up and moved to this crappy little refugee camp. I mean, it was just a dump, you know, and he was living in a tent when I saw him. But that's what's happening. I mean, it's happening kind of in slow motion, but it's definitely happening.
Saddam Hussein was found guilty and is sentenced to hang. Now, assuming that he doesn't win his appeal, and apparently nobody thinks he will, he will be hung perhaps as soon as sometime in the next few months. What effect do you think it's going to have in Iraq if he is hung?
I may be a minority here, but I don't think that it'll have that much effect. I mean, I think he's gone. He's long gone. I mean, I think you can go up to Tikrit, his hometown, and you can, you know, rustle up a bunch of people who think fondly of him. But for the most part, I mean, you know, the Shiites, which is the majority of the country, despise him. I mean, the Kurds will be dancing when he's hung. But even among the Sunnis, this is just a personal opinion based on my experience there, I just don't think there's that much love lost for him. I do think that it'll probably exacerbate, you know, the divisions that are already there. And that won't be a good thing. But I think you could overstate that.
What about the whole idea of, you know, a deposed Arab leader being hanged? How unusual is that, you know, to have somebody legally hanged who had been a head of state?
Well, that's a hard question. I mean, I do think this, which is, you know, you can be against the death penalty for it. But I mean, given the society that Iraq is, mm-hmm. and where it came from and where it's going, I don't think the Iraqi people would understand anything less than the death penalty mm-hmm. for saying. I mean, I think really they wouldn't consider it. The average Iraqi wouldn't consider it justice, wouldn't even be able to kind of apprehend it.
My guest is Dexter Filkins of The New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dexter Filkins. He covered Iraq for the New York Times from the start of the invasion until late August of this year. He profiled Ahmad Chalabi in Sunday's New York Times magazine. You were in London over the summer in August. Part of the reason why you were there is that you were talking to Ahmad Chalabi for this profile that just was published in the New York Times magazine. And while you were there, the plot, the airplane terrorist plot was uncovered, and you did a bunch of interviews around that plot. Among the interviews that you did were interviews with young Islamists in England who saw themselves, I guess, as like Islamic revolutionaries. Having come from Iraq, what was it like to talk with them, and what were, how did they see what was happening in Iraq? Like, what did Iraq mean to them?
Well, it was funny. I flew in from Jordan just to see Chalabi, who was in London at the time. And then I was literally getting in a taxi, go to the airport, and the taxi driver kind of turned around and said, "Hey, bloke, you know, I don't think you're going to be flying today." But so anyway, I kind of pitched in and helped out. But I was really struck by a couple of things in London. One was, I mean, I went out to this neighborhood called Walthamstow, which is sort of eastern London, and there's where a lot of the suspects in the bombing plot was. And what was amazing about it to me, the first thing, the most striking thing was that if you talk to the older Pakistani immigrants, the people who were born in Pakistan, the fathers of a lot of these kids, they were very mellow and very, you know, measured, not terribly upset or angry about anything. But when you talk to their kids, who were born in England, you know, raised in this very free and wealthy society, they were the ones who were angry. And that was really obvious. And it was just very, it was very jarring. It's just not kind of what you would expect, you know. But the second thing that really struck me when I was there was I met with a number of really, really extreme Islamists. I mean, I met with one guy who was running a website that, you know, they post beheading videos and, you know, how to blow up American and British soldiers and that kind of stuff. You know, really, really extreme stuff. And then other guys, I met with these other Islamist leaders who were kind of openly advocating killing British police officers, you know, setting up an Islamic emirate, you know, car bombings, the whole thing. And as they talked, I mean, I had just come from, you know, hell on earth, right? I'd come from the bloodiest place on earth where 100 people a day are dying in the most horrible way. And for a lot of these guys, you know, the violence was very abstract. You know, they live in sort of quiet London, which is, you know, a beautiful and civilized place. And they were talking and kind of waxing about car bombings and suicide bombings and whatever they call them, martyrdom operations. That was really, really, it was offensive because I, you know, if you've ever been to a car bombing and seen the product of, you know, that work, you know, it's hard to feel anything but revulsion for it, you know, the pain that it causes. And these guys were kind of going on and on about how, you know, they were just talking about it in a very abstract way. And it was just really, it was very jarring.
And was it disturbing for you to see that in England as opposed to in Iraq?
Well, I was struck by how many angry people there are in England. Yeah, I mean, I came away with the impression that we haven't heard the last of those people.
When you left Iraq in August, after covering Iraq for several years, was it hard to say goodbye to people there, both Iraqis and journalists who you had been working with?
Yeah. You know, it's been my home for 3.5 years. But, you know, I've almost been killed there more times than I can count. I've kind of, you know, immersed myself and then thrown myself into this this epic, gigantic story. And so in that sense, yeah, I mean, I'm the gravitational pull of the place was very, very strong. But I've got a lot of Iraqi friends there, and some of whom I work with and some of whom I cover, you know, and I write about. And, you know, frankly, you don't know when you say goodbye, you know, whether you're ever going to see him again in a situation like that. You know, we lost an Iraqi on our staff. A stringer that we had was murdered. And
were they murdered because they were a journalist?
Yeah, yeah.
Were Iraqi journalists more likely to get murdered than American journalists because it's seen more as an act of betrayal?
I think it's a question of how well protected you are. I mean, I think, what's the number now? You know, 75 journalists have been killed in Iraq since the war started, I think, which is like more than World War II, more than Vietnam. But I think most of those are Iraqi. Mm-hmm. And there's some foreigners, but most are Iraqi. But yeah, I mean, the guy that worked for us, Fakhr Haider in Basra, great guy. And he worked for other, he didn't work just for us, but he did work for us. Yeah, they killed him for what he was doing. And he was doing, you know, he was doing what he was doing because he understood the historical moment he was in. I mean, he totally got it. And that's the, you know, that's the tragedy of Iraq, you know. The good guys are dead.
After having spent several years in Iraq covering the war there, now you're living in Boston. You have a journalism fellowship, and I'm sure you've been watching and reading coverage in the United States of the election. And, of course, the war in Iraq has been a big issue in the election. So I'd be interested in hearing your observations about how Iraq is being discussed as an election issue. You know, after having been there, sitting back and watching it discussed, you know, politically in America.
Well, I kind of think that the debate hasn't really started. It seems to me, you know, that it's a pretty juvenile debate. I mean, on one hand, you have people saying, stay the course, which, I mean, unfortunately has midwifed this disaster, this catastrophe. And on the other, you have kind of get out, which I think isn't much of an answer either. I mean, maybe it's the only answer, but that simply, it's not an answer. And so it's kind of I don't think it's been terribly constructive. And I have the impression that, you know, you've got the Baker Commission, and which is supposed to make a bunch of recommendations, I guess, as early as this week about what to do. And I kind of think, you know, depending on how the election goes, you know, there might be a pretty serious debate that begins after the election. But I kind of feel like it hasn't really started yet.
Well, you're in Boston now, and you're there on a Nieman Journalism Fellowship. So you've gone from the mayhem and calamity and of Iraq to a college campus. Is it hard to adjust?
Yeah, it's very hard. Yeah, it's very quiet here. It's a little too quiet. I found myself missing the crash and bang of Iraq. It's this kind of weird but singular fact that most car bombings or most explosions happen, you know, between the hours of 8 and 9 in the morning, or so it seems that way. The ones that we usually hear at our place, and you know, if you've been up until 3 or 4 in the morning the night before, it's a pretty, you know, it's I've been woken up many, many mornings by the walls shaking and you know, the sounds of explosions. And suddenly to come up to a place like Cambridge, Massachusetts, which, you know, the loudest sound is like, you know, a garbage man throwing the lid. Yeah, it's pretty jarring.
Do you have anything like, you know, post-traumatic stress coming back at you now that you're in a safe place?
Well, I don't like cars backfiring. Yeah. Yeah, that kind of stuff is, I'm kind of tense.
Is driving difficult, period? Because you're so used to the dangers associated with driving in Iraq.
Yeah, I don't drive. I don't want to drive. But I don't have a car, fortunately. I don't need one. But if I had to drive, I don't know what I would do at the moment. It'll take me a while.
Did you drive before?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have to drive now, but driving in, I mean, you could say this for any Middle Eastern country, driving in the Middle East is just insanity, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's Iraq or not, but especially in Iraq because it's so dangerous. But I'd rather not drive for a while.
Well, Dexter Filkins, it's nice to end a conversation with you knowing that, you know, tomorrow you're not going to be flying into Iraq and all of the dangers there. So I just want to say thanks for all the risks that you took to keep your readers informed of what was happening in Iraq. And thank you, as always, for talking with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins covered Iraq for the New York Times from the start of the invasion until August of this year. His profile of Ahmet Chalabi was published in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Coming up, John Powers reviews a new DVD collection of 50 years of art house films. This is Fresh Air. Janus Films was a pioneer distributor of art films by the likes of Fellini, Bergman, and Kurosawa. To celebrate its 50 years in business, it's launched a nationwide tour of its films and released a massive new DVD box collection called Essential Art House, 50 Years of Janus Films, collecting 50 of its most famous films. Our critic at large, John Power, says the movies are not only good, but offer a glimpse into our cultural past.
We all like to think that our taste is our own, that I like what I like because I like it. But in truth, much of our supposedly personal taste is simply a matter of time and place. Although my mother always adored the movies, a love she passed on to me, she never watched a single foreign film. When she was a kid, nobody showed them, and by the time they were readily available, she was too old to feel comfortable with them. The subtitles struck her as strange and alien, just as so many kids today feel put off by subtitles or even black and white photography. Things were different for my generation. By the late 1960s, seeing foreign movies had become a routine cultural experience, and I spent my college weekends watching classics by Bergman and Fellini, Buñuel and Truffaut. Over time, I came to associate such movies with a company logo, the two-faced head of Janus Films. You can imagine my nostalgia while I learned that this company was bringing together the cream of its catalog for a DVD collection, Essential Art House, 50 Years of Janus Films, which contains a whopping 50 films and a commemorative book. The result is less a conventional DVD package than an invaluable introduction to foreign film literacy. In fact, merely to name the titles is to call up some of the high points in movie history. There's Jean Renoir's great country house tale, The Rules of the Game, often voted the greatest film ever made, with its lesson that everybody has his reasons. There's The Chess Game with Death in Bergman's The Seventh Seal, The Old Man Alone in the Snow in Kurosawa's Akiru, Louise Brooks' iconically bobbed hair in Pandora's Box, old Miss Freud disappearing on that train in Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes, and the famous freeze frame of Antoine Donnell on the beach at the end of The 400 Blows. And then there's the Ferris wheel encounter between Joseph Cotten's Holly Martins and his black marketeer friend Harry Lime, played by Orson Welles, in The Third Man. Here, Harry cheerily dishes up one of the most quoted riffs of the last century.
Well, what the fella said, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
Now, Essential Art House isn't historically comprehensive. There's no Murnau, no Dreyer, no Bresson, no Godard. And it does contain some DVDs that are frankly inessential, like The Condescending Black Narcissus, or Anthony Asquith's banal adaptation of The Importance of Being Earnest. But it remains a great collection that, among other things, fills me with respect for the commercial savvy of Janus's owners, who locked up the rights to all the movies I mentioned earlier, plus classics I haven't mentioned by the likes of Fellini, Buñuel, Polanski, Antonioni, Ozu, and Eisenstein. These were the movies that defined the image of foreign films in the era when they first became popular, back in the mid-1950s and early 1960s, which is why the Janus Collection may best be seen as an astonishing time capsule. It reflects the taste and assumptions of a period when foreign films offered an exciting alternative to Hollywood. They showed life in other countries from the inside. They tackled the great humanistic themes of love and death, war and justice, guilt and redemption. And they had a willingness to grapple with adult material that American movies seemed to be afraid of, especially sex, a subject that American movies still fear. Needless to say, no small part of these films' allure was that they were Tony. They flattered the post-war middle class's sense of cultural aspiration. Of course, over the last 40 years, the world has moved on from Bergman and Fellini and Truffaut. Any new list of essential arthouse films would have to include later directors like Fassbinder, Almodovar, Kiarostami, and Wong Kar-wai. And today's most devoted fans of foreign films care less about highfalutin humanistic themes than sheer pop excitement. They're turned on by anime and Asian horror. Which isn't to say that the essential arthouse collection is somehow passé. The movies in this voluminous box set don't merely hold up as movies, but as enduring cultural touchstones for those who grew up watching them, especially the baby boomers who cared about them the most. These movies forever helped shape an entire era of popular taste. All this time later, when somebody says the words foreign film, the post-war generation instantly thinks of Jewels and Jim or The Seven Samurai, not the latest winner from Cannes, whatever that might be.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from CNN, presenting Election Night with Wolf Blitzer, Anderson Cooper, Lou Dobbs, Paula Zahn, and Larry King, tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern, on CNN. From Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral specializations online at capella.edu. And from Warner Home Video, presenting The West Wing, the complete seventh season, 22 episodes of the final season, and over an hour of special features on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a search for six of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust. Daniel Mendelsohn discusses his new book, Lost. It's about investigating what happened to his great-uncle's family. Mendelsohn had discovered letters from the family begging their relatives in the U.S. to help them get out of their Ukrainian town, but they never made it. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.